Hello and welcome to the Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're in Hong Kong for the last part of a special series of programmes on the UBS Future of Finance Forums. The forums bring together industry leaders, experts and innovators to unpack the challenges and opportunities shaping the future of the financial services industry. The first event in London back in September focused on digital identity. The second in Zurich focused on automation and artificial intelligence, particularly in banking and finance. This instalment, entitled Beyond Money, focuses on investment in alternative assets in the digital age. Some of the brightest minds in the business will be addressing plenty of fascinating questions, such as which asset classes are being digitised and how does this represent an opportunity for wealth management beyond money? How do we understand what makes a digital marketplace grow and function, and what drives people to invest digitally in alternatives? And how can we evaluate non-money wealth? We start with a word from Cathy Shee, president of UBS Asia Pacific, who sets the scene for this forum. She began by explaining why this area is of such interest and importance to her and her colleagues at UBS.
In our view, there are key reasons why debating the future of alternative assets is very timely. Since the financial crisis, diversifying out of long-only equity funds and fixed income investments has become attractive for many investors. Additionally, with fixed income instruments offering very low returns and interest rates remaining low, strategies to achieve greater returns have been top of mind for investors. We already see this with our clients. Similarly, we see exponential growth in digital channels and new algorithms and technologies that enable the digitization of assets. In APAC, it's also estimated that investment into alternative assets will see a double-digit percentage CAGR to 2020. It's estimated that by 2020, global assets in alternative investments will grow to $18 trillion from approximately $12 trillion today. This presents attractive opportunities for this market, but it also presents challenges. We need to be cognizant of how investing digitally in alternative assets could affect the value chain for banks, how this space could be regulated, and where challenges lie. Today's debate will cover these questions.
Will Ross, Managing Partner and Head of Innovation at Nest, explained more in his keynote address about the background to this area.
Cathy mentioned an amazing statistic, $16 trillion worth of assets going into alternative investments. That's unbelievable. But what that does, and what to me that really denotes, is the incredible inflation we've had across all asset classes since the financial crisis on the basis of liquidity being poured into the system. Quantitative easing one, quantitative easing two, Abenomics, pick it. In each case, we've had money being put into the system and money looks for a home. And for me, the way of understanding that intuitively is the champagne pyramid at a wedding. You keep pouring it atop, and eventually that glass will overflow and will spill over into the next glass and into the next glass and into the next glass. And the same is true with money and wealth. And we've seen that. We've seen asset price inflation in Hong Kong. Especially, you know, if you have the classic definition of inflation of too much money chasing too few goods, at some point in time, your glass will fill up and spill over into another sector. And in real estate, an asset class traditionally associated with alternative investing, we often see that in gentrification. It's a classic story, you know, a neighborhood is a bit sketchy today, the artists move in. So art's very important. Ask these guys where they're hanging out. It'll tell you where to buy your real estate. And then it becomes the cool neighborhood tomorrow. And I think what's important, if you think about that, particularly in a context of real estate, is what does it mean when you already have champagne in your glass? For me, that's the intrinsic value of any asset. No matter how sketchy the neighborhood is today, if you're able to lease out the property within or the space within that investment you've made, you have some return. There is some intrinsic value. Now, where does that value truly grow? Or where does that truly become something that is a meaningful component of your wealth is when the intrinsic value is joined by what I would describe as some optionality of its realization, right? Soho in New York, very sketchy in the 70s, one of the most expensive places today. It's still physical property. You can still lease it out, but the capital value, because the market accepted this as the norm, grew tremendously. And this validation is something that we will see across all different asset classes. You know, there was a day when somebody traded the first treasury. There was a day when somebody did the first dollar swap. All of these things are incredibly commoditized today. But things like Bitcoin, which today may seem esoteric to some, will in a different form or in the current form also have that type of validation. And what helps drive that is a large part is the liquidity of the opportunity seeking those things.
We'll have more from Will in a moment. But next, we explore the process of the digitalization of assets. Bert-Jan Van Essen is the founder and CEO of Dragon Wealth Asia. We caught up with him and asked, which asset classes are being digitized and how does this represent an opportunity for wealth management beyond money?
If you look at the asset classes which are at the moment being digitized, it's really about, let's say, for example, investments in private companies. So it will be through, let's say, crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, very much more easy for, let's say, smaller investors to target smaller companies where they can invest in a bit of the company instead of going, let's say, through a venture capital fund or making, let's say, a very large and difficult commitment to invest in a fund. So that's one of them that you would see. But of course, also fractional ownership of, let's say, luxury items like boats is something where you could really look into, let's say, an asset securitization for it.
We put the same question about wealth management beyond money to Will Ross.
If you look at asset classes, you break them down, fundamentally there's debt and equity, right? I lend you money, I buy a portion of you. All of that is being digitized. Everything from ownership of physical goods through to usage rights. And so the digitalization is happening for everything other than when you actually, you know, you can only hold a diamond in your hand, but you can trade its value.
A critical question that continued to raise its head during the various sessions in Hong Kong was, what makes an asset class digitally investable and the market function? Bert-Jan Essen again.
One of the most important things, and let's take the example of the securitization of a small company where you want to invest in. One of the items is that the investors, most of the time, they don't have the know-how or the transparency actually to invest into that company. And through securitization, for example, via a crowdsourcing platform or in other methods, you can actually get way more information about that company and really understand much more about that company before, prior to making your investment. And after you have made the investment, platforms like that will be able to report to you how's the company doing, how are their metrics, where are they going about, so that you can have a good feeling about it. And then in the next stage, actually, the transaction itself, so selling or buying of shares or extra shares, is something where you can get access to. So I believe, let's say, that securitization platform for investing in smaller companies or growing companies is a prominent example there.
Indeed, moving from the physical to the digital means there's a huge opportunity here, as Will Ross explained in more detail in his keynote address.
That intrinsic value that I mentioned earlier, the way that it goes, the way that people move to Soho, the way that people follow the artist is by finding the opportunity to create value, by finding a way to create relevance. And every digital asset that we talk about today and will continue to talk about today will only flourish if relevance is found for it, if it helps solve a problem, if it helps illuminate an opportunity, if it helps manage a risk.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll consider how we should evaluate non-money wealth. So, how can we evaluate non-money wealth? Bert-Jan Essen again.
That is very tough because I think that getting a price tag for something which is not so tradable is very hard because, let's say, for example, if you would have invested in that small company or in that boat, the price is from a year ago or for half a year ago. So I believe it is it's harder, but I think that transparency over platforms like that and the information that you get from it might make it more priceable. However, I think that the price levels, as you would see in tradable assets, you will not get it that fast.
It is indeed a considerable challenge in this era to evaluate non-money wealth. Will Ross warms to the theme.
This is a broader question about the view of how you value things, right? So I would argue that one of the most destructive forces that exists in modern capitalism and modern finance has been the cult of shareholder value. The idea that I'm a public company, I have to show quarter on quarter earnings growth and a continued growth in my stock price, or I'm underserving the value of my shareholders. And the idea is that I should prioritize my shareholders over everything else, because if I own the company, I have the deepest alignment of interests with a company. Reality is, I can buy and sell an infinite amount of Apple stock in less than the amount of time that it takes me to buy an iPhone, right? So that alignment isn't necessarily true. The second thing is that companies need to be sustainable to have any value, right? So when we talk about the world being digitized and robots putting everybody out of business, why would a business do that? Well, a business will implement automation or other things to save money, right? To create a margin for themselves. But if they put everybody out of work, there's no customers for their products, right? Look at mining towns in the US or old factory towns in the UK, where unless there's value being created that's being given to consumers to put back into the economy, the marketplace collapses, right? And so, you know, sustainability is key, because you have to think about both sides. You know, there has to be a sustainability of people willing to support a business and allow it to thrive, but at the same time, there has to be a sustainable marketplace for its services. And we as a whole, as we think about wealth, and, you know, there's a saying in Chinese about how wealth never goes beyond three generations, right? That's because of the lack of the sustainability of the business in which that wealth is involved in, and then the family that controls that and the diffusion of control. These are things that need to be applied to how we actually evaluate a company. Right? And so if we say a company has 40% turnover in its staff, how is that sustainable? Right? These are the things I think that are reflected in what you're asking about.
Finally on the program, some insights from the other delegates, panelists and experts at the Hong Kong event. Jehan Chu, managing partner of Gen Advisors, an early-stage blockchain-focused venture capital fund, summarized the findings of one of the workshop sessions.
We said before that we're starting to see digitization of assets such as physical assets like gold and real estate, and also things like ephemeral things like time and labor and computing cycles. So there are many, many different things. And as our friend Will said, everything is being digitized. And I think that trend will continue. How can money, non-money assets be represented digitally? This idea of tokenization, especially blockchain-based tokenization, is increasingly important as a unit, as a method, and an interface for this type of assetization. And how can we ensure accurate and trustworthy links between these digital tokens? And that's really a question which is up for grabs. It's hard to establish this trusted relationship between the physical and the digital, and it's an ongoing question, I think, which everybody needs to be focused on and exploring different types of answers. But our group also came up with this idea that developing standards for these representation and also standards for these links is one of the areas which is, I think, to be developed.
Paolo Cerroni is IBM FinTech thought leader for IBM Watson Financial Services. Paolo explains what the role of a bank in this space is, or could or should be.
I believe that the essence of a bank is to trade the asymmetry of information in front of its customers in a way which is valuable for both of them. And maybe that has not always been the case. Asymmetry of information means that banks might know more than the customer, and the customers trust that that knowledge is used to their benefit. The moment the trust is not there, banks can only do one thing: to gain back the trust from the customers by providing to them cognition and knowledge. And that's why we believe that artificial intelligence is so important in a digital world, because it's an asset that needs to be transferred back to the individuals.
On this point about banks' role in this space, we closed by asking Bert-Jan Essen for his thoughts on how global financial services organizations could and should participate.
Look, I think that bigger companies, like banks, for example, who want to do that, they should actually probably make some seed investments or participations in companies who provide such a platform. I think that would be the first step. So don't try to do it yourself, because I think that the asset that the bank has, or the asset that the bank has, is basically its distribution power and its network. So they use that, and they use somebody else to create a platform.
And we finish with Will Ross's view on the way ahead for global financial services organizations.
Well, I think it's going to come down to the role that they can play in standardization. All right, so derivatives are a bad word sometimes, right? Oh my God, weapons of mass destruction, the old Warren Buffett line. You know, but derivatives started off as a tool for managing risks. They're a form of insurance, if you will, against fluctuations in interest rates or currency exchange rates. to achieve all those three things I talked about, enforceability, transparency of our pricing, and understanding, you had financial institutions coming together through bodies like ISDA to standardize terms. And I think this is the role that financial services or institutions with an interest in financial assets will need to do to really make these markets liquid, is to create some standardization in terms, in enforceability, in transparency, to create individual points where you have visibility on prices.
And that's Will Ross, bringing us to the end of this 123rd edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance every week here on Monocle 24. Special thanks to Kurt Lin in Hong Kong for his reporting and to the rest of the UBS team there. Don't forget that you can hear more on the other forums in this UBS series. Head to monocle.com or your favourite podcast platform to delve into the archive and listen to those shows and all the others in the archive. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.